Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, bird news with Mark Faraday, science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we're going to talk about birds, but I have an email that's been sitting in my email box, I think, since just after our last show from Howie.
It's critter news.
And yes, it's
welcome to critter news.
We will talk about any kind of critter. Howie says, we have a fisher cat that has been taking advantage of our goldfish in our backyard pond. How common are they? What is their diet? How do they nest? And where do they nest? They're not cats, right?
No, they're not cats. Yeah, that's one of my...
It's a fisher.
It's one of my buttons that people at work will push. They know I've gone on this rant before. So this is a good springboard for my semi-annual fisher rant. it was a good question. And, I thought about it a little bit, and I actually went back and forth with Howie over email. And so my initial theory was that it was not a fisher, and I think people go down the wrong road with them because of the name.
Mm-hmm.
The name makes no sense. I don't know why they're called a fisher. They eat primarily mammals and birds. They're not associated with water. There are other members of the weasel family. They're weasels, so they're not cats. This is just this, like, redneck name for them that won't die. I mean, just every single person calls them fisher cat, mm-hmm. and they're not a cat. I'm not sure where that came from. They're a big weasel. They're the second biggest member of the weasel family, maybe third.
Mm.
I would think an otter would be heavier. Anyway, it goes like wolverine, fisher, otter. So those are the biggest members of the weasel family, and then all the way down to least weasel, which is like barely bigger than a mouse. They're not a member of the weasel family that really eats fish in any large proportion. They hunt squirrels. They're very arboreal. They hunt squirrels in trees. They're known for eating porcupines in places where there are porcupines. They're one of the only things that can, batter a porcupine around and get at the soft underbelly and actually eat a porcupine.
Crows. My husband saw them going up a tree into a crow nest.
Eat crows?
Maybe baby crows?
Oh, they'll eat anything. Yeah, they're a generalist predator.
Crows were going crazy as this fisher was climbing up the tree.
Yeah, just about anything will eat anything. This is something I've talked about before. So I want to talk about fishers in that context and the kind of the PR around fishers, things I don't understand about people's perceptions of this animal that I think is a really cool animal and something that I'm glad is now on the Cape. 20 years ago, they weren't here that we knew of. And so over the last 15 years, I'd say, they've colonized the Cape, kind of recolonized the Cape, mm-hmm. as, forests are growing up and they're becoming a little more comfortable with suburbia. And so they've been spreading east across the state and reclaiming old territories for many years. And so this puts them, this is kind of put them in suburban lore, every suburban homeowner has all of these, is an expert in fishers for some reason. You can test this, right? and rural folk too, maybe especially. Go on some forum that deals with birds or wildlife right now, and remind me that I didn't answer Howie's question yet, and I'm going to get back to that.
Yeah.
what we think it really was. But go on some forum right now. There's a Falmouth Wildlife one. It used to be Falmouth Birds or any forum, and start talking about a fisher. Say you had a fisher. First thing that will happen is someone will call it a fisher cat. The second thing that will happen is someone will say, those are vicious. It's guaranteed. Somebody will say, this is not someone who has ever seen a fisher or has any idea what they're talking about.
Has anybody ever been attacked
by
a fisher?
People feel, I don't know.
I've never heard of it.
They weigh 9 pounds.
Yeah.
It's like being attacked by a scrawny, underweight cat.
Do you think it's because they have those long claws? People just
they
assume...
don't have long claws.
No?
I don't know what it is. There's all this bizarre misinformation. People think they're like the boogeyman. And so someone will say they're vicious. And then the third thing is someone will say, I hear them screaming all the time. And none of these people have probably ever seen a fisher or done any kind of research. But it's just something about this animal that everybody is an expert in all the various misinformation about them. And they don't really make sounds that the average person would ever hear. The New York Times interviewed a fisher researcher, a guy who'd spent years of his life studying them, and he's like, I've never heard them make any sound. They're weasels. Weasels are not vocal animals.
Okay, there's a picture of one. Just pull it up. And they're actually kind of cute.
Oh, they're great. They're fuzzy mammals.
You're right. They don't have super long claws.
And the vicious thing cracks me up. They're just predators. Like, are great horned owls vicious? A great horned owl is vicious killer,
see, look,
Mindy.
It says fisher or fisher cat. See?
I know everything. I'm a wildlife biologist, so I'm allowed to have my pet peeves about people's perception of wildlife. Forgive me.
No, I was going to say that's another pet peeve a lot of ornithologists have is the seagull. No such species, right?
I've given that up a long time ago. Yeah. You sort of go through a phase as a birder. When you're like an intermediate birder, where you know more than you used to, but you're kind of in the middle somewhere, and that you go through a phase where you correct the people about when they say
seagull.
You correct them when they say seagull. Yeah. You know, it's gull because they're not all on the ocean because some of them nest inland. And it's true. There are gulls that nest in freshwater marshes in the middle of the continent, but most of them end up on the ocean at some point in their lives. And I've stopped correcting people.
You know, a lot of kids' books, as you know, will say seagull. I just, when I read the books to my grandson, I just skip the sea part. So he says gull.
I know that when you know wildlife, you have to do that with kids' books.
Yeah, because there's a lot of misinformation.
Right. So we just got a hand-me-down puzzle book, a really cool book for Beckett, my 2-year-old, and we're going through it. And it's got this picture of a polar bear and a penguin together. And I'm just like slapping myself in the forehead, like, you know, there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere. We never see a polar bear with a penguin. So Beckett, please disregard this puzzle piece.
All right. So back to Howie's question about you think
there
was
a question?
Yes, about the fish. You don't think you saw? He sent a picture.
I think it was a mink. And so,
a mink.
Mink are very aquatic. Minks basically look like a small fisher. They look like they're the same color. They're the same shape. They have that kind of mustelid, that weasel family long. Body plan where they sort of slink along like an inchworm almost in high speed. and mink, if you want to see a mink, probably the best place to look for them is in the rocks along the canal, like down by Scusset. Mm. And I have photos of them from this. It's the first time I've ever been able to photograph and actually watch a mink just behaving. And I watched this mink diving into the canal, into the full seawater, Cape Cod canal, and coming up with cunner. This ocean fish. And so they dive for fish. And going back and forth with Howie, he said that this animal actually dove into the koi pond and was under the water for a little bit before coming up with a fish. A fisher would never, this was a mink.
And how frustrating for Howie, like your koi pond. Yeah. Get out of my koi pond.
Yeah. I don't get the whole koi thing, but, like really expensive outdoor fish. But, you don't want to lose them.
Yeah, I would imagine ospreys see that, they're going to come down and take a few.
Seen osprey carrying koi around. I remember I was playing in a baseball game at the field in Hyannis, the Haba Hawks field, and an osprey brought in this like day glow orange fish. It was like, oh, somebody's koi pond is missing a fish.
And the fishers are nocturnal, right? That's why we don't see them a lot, right?
Yeah, they're fairly secretive. Occasionally, like when they first made it to the Outer Cape, there was a woman who would call me. She's like, she saw it just like running around chasing her neighbor's cat in broad daylight. And so they're another, people blame them for their cats going missing. It's possible. Mm-hmm. It's hard to know exactly what happens when a cat doesn't come back. Coyotes are
mostly likely.
Mostly people
blame
owls. Coyotes or
owls.
There's a lot of things that can happen to a pet that's being sent out into the wild, and you shouldn't expect anything less.
I don't know if you remember this. It was at least a decade, even maybe more ago in the Outer Cape. It was a lot of cats that were blaming coyotes for a lot of these cats disappearing, and then they kind of figured out that it was not cats, it was an owl or owls.
It wasn't coyotes, it was not,
It was owls, yeah.
I believe that. Eagles have been documented, this is one of the potential pitfalls of putting a camera on a raptor nest. There were some eagles and they were bringing cats back, or at least one. It just takes one for the internet
to get into
an uproar.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 for your bird or critter comments, questions, stories. We're open to all of it. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. You mentioned osprey, and we are seeing signs of spring everywhere. Woodcocks are displaying.
We've got
the ospreys will be back any minute. We hear reports that some people have seen them already, but is that possible?
There have been some credible reports, February reports, for the second year in a row, at least the second year in a row. I haven't seen any photos or anything like that, but, people who know osprey. Mm-hmm.
It's been a mild winter, that's for sure.
Right. There are some that maybe, wintered a little further north and they can can come up early and test the waters if it's a mild year. So we've the first wave, the early wave of migrants is now well established. So we're through phase one of the bird migration.
And who's phase one?
Phase one is grackles and red-winged blackbirds and vultures.
But we do have
woodcocks,
some red-winged blackbirds. We do have some year-round.
Yeah,
because
right.
especially here, see them on my way to work.
Right.
Yeah.
There are things that we have some year-round. So most turkey vultures and red-winged blackbirds and grackles, almost, you know, most of them leave most of the state. But increasingly, things with like red-winged blackbirds, we typically have a small winter flock of red-winged blackbirds at the sanctuary in Wellfleet. We actually used to have more. Say 10 years ago, there was a bigger flock year-round. People around here, Woods Hole, I know will see the occasional grackle in the winter. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a small population of turkey vultures kind of centered around the Bourne landfill and, you know, on the vineyard in the winter. But you don't see turkey vulture reports east of Sandwich until February.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in eBird and I looked at this. And so those are the migrants coming back. When you start seeing them out in the Outer Cape where I am, those are migrants. And so they're a late February migrant. And they don't. There's some vultures don't go very far. They don't go very far south. A lot of them go all the way to South America. But others, you know, might just winter in Connecticut or something. And so they'll just pop back.
Yeah.
And then woodcocks don't migrate very far. So and they routinely will be on territory. Some will be on territory in February, already displaying.
Yeah.
And so they're in full swing now. You know, the red-winged blackbirds are back in the swamps singing. And we've already, like, the first and second wave sort of overlapped because there was a piping plover report on Nantucket in mid-February.
Wow.
A month early. And oyster catchers as well. And then there have been there were some osprey reports in February. So that's usually the second wave that comes in mid-March. And they sort of overlapped a little bit this year with the mild winter, something that'll probably happen more and more. But I'd say around St. Patrick's Day is usually when we expect the first ospreys and piping plovers. And then from there on out, they just more and more of them every day. That hasn't really happened yet, so we still have that to look forward to, the full-on kind of second wave of migrants that your average person would notice, big, obvious things. Yeah.
And I'll tell you where you can see a red-winged blackbird any time of the year, it seems to me. It's over by, when you're coming down Surf Drive by Trunk River there. I just saw one this morning up on the telephone lines, the wires up there.
Mm-hmm.
See them, you know, almost through the whole winter, you know, just hanging out there. Doing their morning thing.
Yeah. I mean, they winter in large numbers in parts of southeastern Mass, like agricultural Bristol County, the kind of like Rhode Island lowlands that bleed into southeastern Massachusetts. And, you know, those agricultural areas will have big flocks of wintering blackbirds.
And I don't see big flocks. I see like one.
Right.
It's only one little lonely one.
Yeah. A few singletons.
Saying, I'm not going south. I'm hanging out
here. A few singletons is also a regular thing to see, yes.
It is Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number right into the program. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It is Bird News this morning with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're finding some good birding is to be found in some cemeteries around the listening area.
Yes.
Especially, in East Ham?
Yeah, you would think it would be kind of a dead scene. Yeah, there's all kinds of terrible cemetery jokes.
It's a very meditative place to take a walk.
Yeah, and some of them are really beautifully landscaped, and they're sort of a pseudo-arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some very famous cemeteries for birding. The biggest one around here is Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Watertown. And so that's just a standard place to go birding, particularly in May for migration. And there's just so many different kinds of trees there, old trees, there's some wet areas there. And because it's an oasis in a city, it tends to attract fallouts of migrants that, you know, obviously can't hang out in Somerville or whatever. So they're going to drop down into Mount Auburn Cemetery and spend some time there. there's another one in Providence. There's a famous one, Swan Point Cemetery. It's actually the biggest green space in the city of Providence,
I've
Rhode Island.
I've never been there. I have to check
that
out.
Yeah, and it's a big, beautiful place, and that's their famous place to go birding in spring, particularly for warblers and, you know, other kind of neotropical migrants that are coming through in May. But locally, there's one in East Ham called Evergreen Cemetery, and I've driven by this a million times over the years. It's on my commute to work. It's right up the road from the sanctuary in Wellfleet. And my colleague, Jim Sweeney, who works for us now, he went in there. He might have, I don't know if he took a group in there, but he found a rare bird earlier in the winter in this little, it's a tiny little cemetery in East Ham, right on Route 6. And, you know, I've seen, you can sometimes see bluebirds sitting on the wires as you drive by on Route 6. I wasn't totally unaware of it, but he went in there and he found a clay-colored sparrow with a big flock of chipping sparrows. And these birds have spent the entire winter there, so tons and tons of birders have stopped into this little cemetery. And it's easy to bird cemeteries because they have all those little roads through them. Mm-hmm. You don't even have to walk very much. You can sort of drive right up to whatever bird you're looking for. But it's better to get out and walk. And certainly you have to be respectful. You have to have, you know, some common sense about things that might be going on at a cemetery. But this is a pretty sleepy little cemetery. And you're probably more likely to run into a birder than anybody else at this point looking for this clay-colored sparrow, which is a rare sparrow at any season. But to have one overwintering is pretty unusual. And to have that many chipping sparrows overwintering is very unusual. Typically, they're gone for the winter. They're a complete migrant as far as Massachusetts goes. They all leave for the winter. But you can find a few here and there sometimes, like on a Christmas count or whatever. But there was a flock of like 14 of them wintering in this cemetery. I don't know why. It's just this... It's not a particularly well-manicured, that's probably why, it's not a particularly well-manicured cemetery, and they just feed in the short grass and on whatever it is they're eating, little seeds. And this clay-colored has been there, and so it's been an easy get in terms of a rare bird all winter long. So don't discount your local cemetery when you're, you know, looking for local places to bird. Especially in spring, screech owls like cemeteries. It's often, you know, you can find owls as well as songbirds in cemeteries. So,
all right, birds you just mentioned, bluebirds. we're seeing a lot of bluebirds being posted on some of these wildlife, as you're saying, Facebook pages and things.
Yeah, so
it's a good year for bluebirds. How about at the sanctuary? When you have all the bluebird boxes, you have a lot of bluebirds.
Yeah. We had a good year last year for nesting bluebirds. And good year meaning they fledged a lot of chicks. This winter, I don't know if there were more than usual. I mean, it was a milder than usual winter, and that tends to favor them. But they're around every winter. Mm-hmm. You can find bluebirds if you look for them in every month of the year on Cape Cod. And so the question now, I got some questions about bluebirds at Cape Cod Bird Club last night. and so somebody was wondering, you know, I'm seeing a bluebird checking out the box in my yard. Are those my bluebirds?
Very possessive, my bluebirds.
They belong to all of us. They're not your bluebirds. What he obviously meant was, are those the bluebirds that I had nesting here last year? And they could very well be. And I haven't quite figured out, I don't know if anybody knows whether, you know, the bluebirds that we see here on the Cape in the winter are probably a mix of migrants from further north, and I would guess we have some that don't leave. And the same as might be true of robins. And I'm not sure how to tell. You'd have to color band some and, you know, really look at who's going where. So I think some of these bluebirds that are checking out boxes right now, they're local nesters. Mm-hmm. I mean, they start checking pretty early. It doesn't mean much, you know, like they do it to me every year. They check out my boxes and then break my heart. They don't nest in them. Maybe I get some titmice. But the bluebirds, they were doing it last week. I think exactly a week ago, it was a beautiful morning, and I could hear all these bluebirds. There were like six or seven bluebirds in my yard, and they were calling, and they're fighting, and the males are fighting over the females, and they're singing, and they're poking into this nest box that I have that's at the edge of a little small power line right away. And so my heart sang, and then they moved on, and I haven't seen them since. So they're just, you know, they're in the early stages of house hunting what's going on right now.
And
so
if you're lucky, they'll choose you.
Yeah, don't get your hopes up, but, you know, have some boxes out, have them cleaned out. You know, keep your hopes up, but don't expect them to definitely nest in your box just because they poked their heads in in early March. Yeah.
You want a bird question or story for us? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Marilyn writes, we live next to a pond in Chatham, and last year we put up a wood duck box. We've never seen a wood duck, only hooded mergansers and buffleheads, but thought we'd give it a shot. Last weekend, my husband went down to clean it out for spring. When he lightly tapped on the box, a screech owl flew out and landed in a nearby branch. He slowly backed away, and the owl flew back in the box. I looked up when they nest, and it sounds like April, so it's probably just a daytime roosting spot. But my question is, do they nest in the same boxes where they roost? The water is high right now, so the nest box pole is completely surrounded by water, which doesn't seem like a good place for an owl nest.
Yeah, the answer is not necessarily, and I've heard people say that they think they as a rule don't nest in the box that they roost in. I would doubt that there's any absolute rule about it, but it's certainly not a guarantee. You can start there, but it's worth keeping an eye on, and hopefully she'll check in again if they do decide to nest. I'd love to know that, so be good to check in. I sadly don't have personal experience with this. I've never had screech owls nesting in my yard anywhere that I've lived, and I've never, in the course of my work, I've never like monitored screech owl boxes or anything like that. So I don't really have a lot of personal experience. Most of what I know is what I read on the Cornell Nest Watch site. Mm. Things like, you know, when people ask me questions, I usually direct them there, and you know, questions like, what direction should the box face?
Yeah.
And, according to them, it
doesn't matter. Yeah, we've had that question.
Yeah, so they're a good source of information for things like that.
Marilyn has a second part to this question. She sent us a photo. This past Sunday, my husband and I watched a fox eating a dead fox in a yard on the Count Hollow Road in Wellfleet.
Oh, right.
The living fox was definitely actively eating the other, not just investigating. This seems highly unusual to me. Is it? And she did attach a photo that's not the best. But she said the fox did seem thinner than the ones we've seen around our house lately.
Well, it is a fox-eat-fox world out there.
So it's not unusual then?
It's not. I mean, things eat other things. I mean, these animals are trying to stay alive, right? So if they're hungry and it's a question of surviving the night, then they'll do it. I mean, snowy owls have been documented eating other snowy owls. It's cannibalism is not something that's unheard of in nature. And, you know, it's from our perspective, it's pretty grim. You know, you like to see your fuzzy, healthy fox running around eating your chipmunks or whatever. But if they're hungry and they'll take that opportunity, who knows how the other fox died? They could have fought. It could have killed the other fox, or it could just be scavenging the carcass. But it's not something I find terribly surprising.
Okay. What's up with the Western tanagers?
Oh, I don't know. This is like the year of the Western tanager. So this is a species that it's a beautiful species of tanager. People around here know the scarlet tanager. I would say even casual birders are usually familiar, or people like backyard people are usually familiar with scarlet tanagers. A brilliant, brilliant red bird with black wings that comes back in May and nests kind of sparsely in some of our more mature woods around here. Not very common, but. There are other tanagers in other parts of the world. The tropics are just riddled with hundreds of species of tanagers. But in the western U.S., there's the western tanager, which is a beautiful yellow bird. A male is yellow with black wings, white wing bars, and then a red face. Hmm. In the winter, they tend to be a lot more subtle. They're just sort of a yellowish bird with dark wings and wing bars, kind of a pale bill. And there was one in Plymouth in December. There was one in Sandwich that turned up on the Mid-Cape Christmas count, and then it moved to this other house on Oriole Lane in Sandwich. So I'm wondering if that one is still there. And then in the last few days, one turned up on Nantucket at a feeder. And this is someone's feeder. They, you know, they look at their feeders every day. It's not like it was there 2 weeks ago and they missed it. So this is a reason. That's why I always say keep checking your feeders. You know, I mean, rare birds, you know, sometimes they'll settle in somewhere at the beginning of the winter and they won't move around, but other times they do move around, and you could get something wacky even at the end of the winter.
Good, and it's good to know, right?
Yeah.
That whole citizen science thing. Yeah.
And so I don't know what I don't know why there were so many Western tanagers this year, but it should ordinarily be a very rare bird, but we've had several in this region.
Let's talk to Alex, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Good morning, Alex.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
I wanted to call in about a bird sighting. The other day, I saw a Baltimore Oriole at the feeder in my backyard, and I heard it's quite early for these birds. But I was absolutely thrilled because I'm a Maryland native, and they're the state bird down there, and never saw them. And then I moved out here to the Cape 3 years ago for the AmeriCorps program, and I was just, you know, absolutely thrilled to see a Baltimore Oriole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, they're great. I mean, they're intensely beautiful birds. A male Baltimore Oriole is a real work of art and a treat when they come back at the very end of April, early May. Certainly by early May, they're back. But I would say that the bird you saw is not early. They don't tend to be this early. It was late. And there's some small number of Baltimore Orioles that attempt at least to overwinter here on the Cape. And, you know, some of them turn up at feeders, but others don't. They just, they tend to like areas with a lot of cedars. And when the cedars fruit heavily, then that's something they can feed on along with other fruits, bittersweet, and, you know, other kind of persistent winter fruits, winterberry, things that birds eat in the winter that are persistent fruits that are available to them. I think they can get insects too, but we don't think of them as a winter bird. Really, in the Northeast, and they're not. It's a bird that's supposed to go to Central America and winter there, and 99% of them do. But for whatever reason, kind of like catbirds, some number of catbirds winter here. People don't realize that they're skulking in thickets. But when an oriole turns up at your feeder, you don't miss it.
All right, so Alex, a lucky sight for you. Thanks for sharing that. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. It's Bird News with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. 866-999-4626 for your bird comments, questions, or stories. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Got a couple of updates from last month's show, right? You wanted to say something about mealworms? Did you give a little...
Yeah, so I'm not really firing on all cylinders these days.
You've got a little baby at home. And
yes, yeah. I had
toddler.
My first Phoebe of spring was my daughter Phoebe, who was born on February 1st. And then my 2-year-old is really the problem sleeping wise. So I'm not, you know, maybe getting 3 hours of sleep at a time. But anyway, so I'm not really that sharp these days. And last month, I claimed that mealworms turn into moths, but they're beetle larvae. They're not moths at all.
Okay.
And I knew that. And I thought about it afterwards. I was like,
why did I say that?
I said they were moths. But they turn into something called the darkling beetle.
Right.
And if you look at them, they're not caterpillars. The beetle larvae have the legs are, you know, way at the front, and the rest of their long segmented body doesn't have legs on it. So I just wanted to correct that. There was some entomologist out there shaking their head. Come on.
What is he doing?
Come on.
And then the other thing was we had somebody who called in who had a black and white bird.
I know. It was one of those, like, end of the show. Someone calls
minute,
in.
No picture. And
describing
like,
some bird.
Wait,
and I'm
what?
Like,
and you thought
in the headlights.
About that.
And later, I was like, did we talk about Junco? She said like, it was like black and it was white underneath. And that doesn't describe very much. And I would think a backyard bird watcher would be familiar with Juncos, but that's all I could think of.
So maybe it was a Junco.
Yeah, if she could call back in or whatever, if she figured it out, we would like to know. But
right.
I hate getting stumped.
Okay, so this is Felix from West Yarmouth says, when should I put out my hummingbird feeders?
Mid-April is usually the hopefulest time to do it. And there's a website. You Google it up, Hummingbird Watch. I always forget the exact name of it, but there is at least one website that tracks the northward progress of migrant ruby-throated hummingbirds in the east every year, where it shows little tiny dates on the map in terms of when the first sighting was in different areas. And so you watch that kind of wave moving north. And typically there'll be a couple of sightings on the Cape in mid-April. But you're not likely to be one. I mean, it's very few. Like two people will have one in mid-April. And it's not necessarily going to be you. But it could be. And so why not have your feeders out in mid-April? And by a lot of people do May 1st, and they're probably missing some early ones. If you wait till May 1st, then you have no chance, really, of getting one of the early ones. You mm-hmm. probably won't see them if they're around. So, mm-hmm. say mid-April. It's cool then. You don't have to change the water as much. It's not like midsummer where it gets moldy so quickly. And, you know, the nights are still cool. And so it lasts longer. So it's not a big burden to get your feeders cleaned up and, you know, make up some fresh batch of your own nectar, 4-to-1 water to sugar, boil it for a minute. That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, keep it in the fridge. You don't have to buy anything special. Just use the bag of sugar you have for baking, you know, and 4 cups of boiled water, 1 cup of sugar. And that's it. You're good. Mm-hmm. You're good for probably a couple of months.
It doesn't have to be that red stuff they sell in the stores.
Yeah, that's nonsense. Yeah. That's just sugar. You're just overpaying.
Same thing. They just put red dye in it, right?
Right. Yeah. And the red dye is not necessary or good, potentially.
Yeah. Right. Joe is asking us, have we had a confirmed osprey sighting yet?
We talked a little bit about that in the beginning. There have been some credible osprey reports, yes, mm-hmm. in February once again. And so I think there are some out there. I think Wareham.
We just haven't had any photos yet.
Wareham right? might have been. Yeah, I haven't seen any photos. And
but these are people who know what ospreys are.
Yeah, they've been from some people who know what an osprey looks like. So, it doesn't surprise me. I would expect some early ones this year. They know it's a milder than average winter, and so ones that didn't go very far can kind of come back and test the waters and get an early jump on getting a territory. So birds will push that kind of thing. They'll push their migration early if they can, because they're competing for territories. And that's why red-winged blackbird males tend to winter further north and come back earlier, because they're under strong pressure to get a territory that they can defend.
All right, so Joe from Aquoit says, I did not see a single report of any snowy owls visiting Cape Cod this winter. In past years, I have personally observed 9 different snowies. I'm wondering if you can give a summary of snowy owl visits to Cape Cod this winter.
Yeah, there were almost none. Mm-hmm. There were a couple. I think this is going back to December, and then they disappeared and they were just gone. But the islands tend to be primo snowy owl habitat. So Nantucket and the Vineyard both had snowy owls consistently this winter. You know, some of them I think were in fairly remote places that you needed ORVs to get to or whatever, and there weren't a lot of them. But there was a non-zero number of snowy owls in the Cape and Islands, but it was probably the lowest year in recent memory. And this is all driven by lemming populations in their breeding areas. And there's a population in Quebec that seems to be a source population for when we see eruptions. And I would guess that they didn't – I haven't looked into this, and I should, but I would guess that it was not a good lemming year in that kind of core Quebec population that drives our annual fluctuations. And so there were not surplus birds to then erupt southwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. You saw a hawk on the way in. An unusual hawk?
No. This was just... it was a bird I couldn't identify.
What is that?
I saw a bird I couldn't identify.
Were you driving and trying to do that at the same time?
Well, driving is just birding, you know, with occasional looks at the road. That's not true. Drive safely, everyone. But I'm well practiced at noticing birds. I can't not. It's just how I see the world. I'm noticing all aspects of nature all the time and trying to process it. And so, you know, I saw a hawk and I knew it was one of two things. It's either a sharp-shinned hawk or a Cooper's hawk. And it was just one of those like silhouetted, kind of at the wrong angle, frustrating ones that got away. I think it was a sharp-shinned hawk. But it's just a little lesson. Like even people who've been I've been birding since I was 6 years old. I've been a paid hawk watcher studying hawks, looking at them all day long, counting them at some great migration sites. And you just have to let some go. You can't identify every bird.
Well, sometimes you see such a flash, and depending what the light is, you're not really getting you have like a second.
Right. I do think it was my guess is that it was a female sharp-shinned because it looked big. It looked almost Cooper's hawk size, but it looked like it had a really sharp cornered tail. But I couldn't call it. And so it's just an important lesson for all of us. Sometimes you have to let some things go. There's a strong psychological tendency to want to identify everything, especially when you get to a certain level. like, no, I can't have an unidentified hawk. It was a sharpshin hawk, you know, but it's good to be honest and let some IDs go.
Yeah, and for us, it's like sharpshin or Coopers are the two that we are going to mostly be seeing in our backyard feeders. Watching those Coopers hawks fly is amazing.
Oh, they're incredible. They're like fighter jets, and they're built for speed, but they're built for agility in dense woodland environments. So they can slip between branches, you know, an inch and a half apart. I don't know. I mean, they can go through really dense shrubs. A classic Cooper's hawk thing to do is to just burst into a privet hedge and come out the other side with a house sparrow or song sparrow or something like that. I've seen them do it. And so they can, in flight, full speed, maneuver through dense woodlands where they have to slip up, go vertical basically and go sideways for a second to go between two close branches and then keep going. Or another classic thing, and when they're hunting the suburban jungles, is they'll kind of hug the ground and then they'll bounce up over a fence and then go back to the ground.
It's amazing.
They're looking to flush something that they can just grab quickly with barely breaking stride. So they're incredible birds. They're fun to watch. And people will get nervous when they have them around, and they'll full on complain about them. Like, how do I get rid of? What do I do to get rid of this hawk? And like, well, why? Mm-hmm. Hawks are pretty cool. Yes, they eat birds. Everything eats something. I would say enjoy your hawks. But if you don't want to watch them killing your birds, and you can take your feeders down. Everybody's different, but I enjoy
the hawks
to
watch. I've told you this story before, but there was a red-tailed hawk this last summer up in a tree in my backyard, and I watched it for hours, at least 20 minutes, just sitting up there looking around. I think the bird saw me as much as I was watching the bird, and all of a sudden, just quick, down into my garden, which was all bushy. I don't know how he saw, or she, whichever it was, saw this rat, came hopping out with this rat. And I thought, how on earth did it see it and get it that quickly? It's amazing.
I know. It's what they do. It's what they have to be able to do that to stay alive.
So do they have this, like, just great eyesight? Or,
Yes. Right. The owls have the great hearing. Mammalian predators at least can see. The birds too. So they can also see trails invisible to us, urine trails that reflect ultraviolet light that are left by small mammals. So they see evidence of small mammals that we literally are physically incapable of seeing. Their eyesight is unimaginably better than ours. Like, we can't imagine how well. It's like ultra, ultra, ultra HD. and so they're operating on a different level. Yeah.
So this is the time of year, Mark, that we see a lot of vernal pools. Maybe you want to tell folks what is a vernal pool means. What, no fish? This pools of water that dry up in the summer. What's a definition of a vernal pool?
Definition of a vernal pool. So a vernal pool is a temporary pool, usually in a forested area, but not necessarily, so that it dries up at a certain point. Maybe not every year, but it dries up enough that it doesn't have a permanent population of fish. And so this allows a suite of animals that we call vernal pool obligates, meaning they can only complete their life cycle in a fishless vernal pool, to complete their life cycles. Things like spotted salamanders, marbled salamanders, which we don't have here on the Cape, wood frogs. There are certain animals, fairy shrimp. There are certain indicator animals that tell you you're looking at a vernal pool, even if you don't know the hydrology. You're seeing this pool for the first time. You can look at, there are wood frogs breeding here. There are spotted salamander eggs. This is a vernal pool because those are vernal pool obligate species. Mm. And importantly, there's a process for certifying vernal pools in Massachusetts that then gives them some regulatory protection from your local conservation commissions. And this still comes up. You would think after years and years of opportunity for people to get these things certified, there are so many of them out there that there are still uncertified vernal pools. So any amateur naturalists out there who are interested in protecting the wetlands around them, keep an eye out for vernal pools. Check with maps, check with your town to see if they've been certified. And there's a process where you can get them certified through Mass Natural Heritage and Endangered Species Program, which is part of Mass Wildlife. And you can do it online. You can take pictures of it. There are all these different criteria I don't know if they're different than the last time I did it, but obligate animals, pictures of them, it being dried out, things like that serve as evidence, and then you can get it. You can get it certified. But this is the time of year when, you know, as cold as it is, we just had a snowstorm. You know, some of these animals are already in the vernal pools breeding, like wood frogs have started to turn up and start their little choruses. Wood frogs sound like ducks, or they sound like a bunch of people walking in squeaky shoes simultaneously. Wood ducks are great. Wood frogs.
Yeah.
I said wood frogs, yes. Right? Not wood ducks.
Slip of the tongue there. Yeah.
They hang out in the same places.
Yeah.
But wood frogs. And
would we find peepers there?
Peepers. Yeah. Peepers are not vernal pool obligates, but they use them. Mm-hmm. Peepers can breed in a wide variety of wetland types, and people have been hearing peepers already, and they're tough. You can hear peepers just about any month of the year. A few will peep. Mm-hmm. Even in winter, sometimes you get a warm day, you'll hear, you know, a peeper in December or January sometimes. Even wood frogs will sometimes do that. But this is the time. And so spotted salamanders.
Those little spotted salamanders.
A warm, rainy night, you know, if it's around 50 degrees and raining, then these guys are going to be making migrations, sometimes mass migrations, to their local breeding pool. And
do they come back to the same? I'm like, how do they know where these vernal pools are? I mean, the salamander comes along and says, "Oh, is this the one I was at last year?" Or how does that work?
Yeah, they don't tend to be very far from them. You know, so they go into the wooded uplands around their breeding pool, and then these spotted salamanders are what is known as mole salamanders. So they hang out in burrows, and so they'll winter in some kind like a mammal burrow or something underground. Not necessarily very far from their breeding pool. And so they come out of these burrows. They'll be at like a warm, rainy night in maybe even late February, March. And they'll come out and they'll make their way, wriggle their way down to their vernal pool. Hopefully they don't have to cross roads. I encourage people to drive very carefully on warm, rainy nights, really from now all the way through summer.
Wow.
Because rainy nights, amphibians come out and move around the landscape. It's not just now. But if you pay attention, you'll notice this even in summer.
Well, sometimes you can, you'll see a little hopping across
the
road.
Yeah, like frogs, like green frogs and things even will come out of their ponds and move around on the landscape on rainy nights, and they'll end up in roads. So it's good to drive carefully. But especially this time of year with the spotted salamanders. And so, you know, check your local vernal pool. You might see egg masses. You might see the salamanders themselves. It's just a really cool thing this time of year when it's still kind of cold. You know, we talk about all the different bird signs of spring, but the amphibians are trying to tell us as well. And
turtles. We're starting to see some turtles that maybe come out a little bit early.
It seems like it's less and less unusual to see them in late February. But yeah, March 3rd, we have a turtle volunteer extraordinaire, Tim O'Brien, at the sanctuary there in Wellfleet. And he had, on March 3rd, he had his first painted turtles on the sanctuary. they're out. I mean, by the 8th, I was seeing photos of several of them basking.
And when you see one, maybe help it across the road, but don't bring it too far away, right? Because
that point in the season yet. But yes, that's good advice. When we get to nesting season, and they start moving around the landscape. Some might be moving from, you know, their brumation site, their wintering area, to where they'll be spending the spring and summer. So there is some movement in addition to the movement of breeding females. But yes, once breeding females in like May and June, once they start moving around, then you want to help them across the road, help them in the direction that they were going, get them out of the road if you can safely do that. Because turtles are definitely at risk of roadkill.
Yeah. I actually rescued one from my swimming pool last year, but I just picked it up and put it outside the fence.
Was it a painted turtle?
Yeah.
In your swimming pool?
It probably just fell in.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's something that happens, and they can end up in abandoned pools and not be able to find their way out. But Yeah, good for you.
Yeah. All right, so we have an email from Jacqueline here and Robin, who says, we first saw this cardinal last fall. They sent some photos, hopping around with a funny gait and sitting sort of lopsided. We realized that he only had one operative leg, the other trailing at a funny angle. We were concerned about his making it through the winter, so kept a close eye on him, and he's doing well. At first, he couldn't use the bird feeder, having to beat his wings wildly while trying to extract some food. But slowly, over time, he taught himself to sit on the bar, take his time, and get as much as he wanted. In one image, you can see his damaged leg hanging down on the inside of the bar, the other image showing his damaged leg on the outside. We're not sure he'll be able to attract a mate, but we wish him luck. And this is a little bird who you can see he's got kind of a bum leg. And obviously injured somehow, right? So
yeah, it's hard to say. I don't know, some sort of an abscess or a tumor or something like that.
Yeah. What's interesting though is how they sent us a great picture of him sort of sitting on this bird feeder instead of he's.
Yeah, especially when they have artificial food available to them, birds can tough it out. I've seen. There's a female cardinal that was bald. I think I've used this example before, but this was at the sanctuary. And it was a pretty cold winter. And here's this female cardinal with no feathers on her head. You would think, you wanted to knit her a little cap. You would think she would freeze to death. But she did fine. And she even ended up breeding. This was a long-term thing. This wasn't just a temporary loss of feathers for whatever reason, whether it's mites or whatever caused this. She had a long-term loss of the feathers on the top of her head, something I can relate to. It happens. It's fine. She was still beautiful.
Yeah, exactly.
And she did have a nest off of our parking lot the next year. That's a different thing. This is a bird with a serious injury to their leg. But cardinals don't have as many pressures on them as some birds. They don't migrate. They don't tend to go very far. As long as it could fly and perch, then this is a bird that could survive with this little handicap.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it did so. So go that cardinal. Good for him.
All right, are the great horned owls, are they laying on eggs now? Or
yeah, they should be on eggs. Yeah. Yep.
So are they going to be a little bit quiet then for a little bit?
I haven't been hearing them as much. You might still hear them. Certainly, mm-hmm. They don't go completely silent.
Yeah, and so maybe you can listen for when the eggs hatch. When might we hear the little owls? And they sound a little bit different. They're not as whoo as the adults.
No, like completely different. Yeah, they sound. They have a reet. I can't quite do it. Reet. It's a screech, and that's all they can do for the first year of life.
Oh, a whole year.
Young. Wow. And I usually don't hear that until summer. It takes a long time. They're a big bird, and big birds, like big raptors, tend to have a really long nesting cycle. That's why they start in January, February, because it takes a long time to incubate those eggs and then get those chicks to the point where they're big enough to leave the nest and fledge. And so it's usually summer is when I first start hearing the young great horned owls. Mm-hmm. But then you'll hear them. They'll make that sound, like I said, through their first year. And it's a cool sound. You can find it online, but it says.
So we just have about a minute left. It's spring, as we're saying, is pretty much sprung at this point, right? We've got the first wave of migrants, and second wave will be coming in soon. And you don't know what you could. Who knows what we'll see in the coming weeks, right?
Right. Anything could happen, and the weather is a big driver. The weather is very important in spring migration here on the Cape. If we get some strong southwesterlies, then that determines how many we see of certain birds, whether we see a migration of kestrels and some of the other hawks is determined by the wind direction and speed. And if we get some strong southerlies, then, in April, as sometimes happens, then we might get some early migrants, some overshoots that end up further north than they should be at that point in the year. You might get some of these neotropical migrants, buntings and tanagers and things that show up 3-4 weeks early. But it's all driven by weather. So you never know what's going to happen. Check the weather and just keep birding your hotspots.
All right. Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, visits us the second Tuesday of the month. Thanks, Mark.
Catch you next time.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.